Welcome to the Underwater Podcast, where we take a deep dive into the world of underwater portrait photography, cinematography, and everything in between. With me, your host, Brett Stanley. Welcome back to the Underwater Podcast. And this week, it's a rather somber episode as I'm joined by Antonio Lenert, life and business partner to surf and fine art photographer Lucas Murnigan, who died tragically in March this year of a rare cancer. As a way of memorializing Lucas, we talk about his life and work and how Antonio is keeping the memory alive by curating Lucas's images, a lot of previously unseen, into a new gallery work and reissuing his book Beneath the Surface. My chat with Antonio is a great introduction to my interview with Lucas last year, which I've included in today's podcast episode. I hope you join with me in celebrating such a creative talent, and if you'd like to support Lucas's family, please consider purchasing his book or a print. I'll link to the gallery in the show notes. Okay, let's dive in. Antonio, welcome to the Underwater Podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here, man. And you know, I just want to first off offer my condolences for your loss of Lucas. You know, I only kind of really connected with him over the podcast last year, and I just found a really nice, warm, open guy. And to hear of his passing was an absolute shock. So I just want to, you know, kind of let you know that we were thinking about you guys and just want to kind of see how you're feeling about things.
Thank you so much, Brad. That means a lot to me and to the family. And I really appreciate you reaching out to me to talk about this.
It's kind of something that I need to kind of talk about, I think, you know, just for me, because it was, I kind of felt like my relationship with Lucas had just sort of begun. You know, I was looking forward to kind of reconnecting with him and seeing how his work kind of grew and all that sort of stuff. So connecting with you, I feel like, you know, he's still here. He's still in the room.
Yeah, absolutely. He was my life partner, my business partner, and I was there with him for most of his shoots. Like, I saw his career evolve, you know, from the get-go, and I was always there, like, assisting him in any way I can. So, you know, even though he's not physically present anymore, I also feel him, you know, around all the time. And I would say that half of who I am is Lucas. So, you know, he's still around here with us.
Yeah, totally. So can you tell us how you guys kind of met and how his art kind of started, his love of photography?
Yeah, or the way we met was actually very unusual, and it was pure chance, I would say. I used to live in San Diego, California. I'm from Brazil originally. I was there studying interactive media, and I was working at a retail shop. I worked at a denim clothing shop. And he was down there for a medical conference. He was finishing his residency in Vancouver, and he just came down for the conference. So he got bored at the conference and decided to go for a walk in downtown San Diego in the gas lamp area. Right. And he saw G-Star, which was the shop I used to work at, and he just walked in. I think it was like a Wednesday afternoon. And the moment he walked in, like, our eyes locked, and we're both kind of like, you know, started talking. And it was, you know, that dance, you know, the salesperson and the customer. He was super nice. He was really handsome. You know, I was a friendly Brazilian surfer living in San Diego, going to school, you know, and kind of like wanting to make my sales. We weren't quite sure, you know, of each other's sexuality, you know, we were actually interested in one another or not. So, yeah. He ended up trying on, you know, 20 pairs of jeans, of denim pants, even right. The ones that I, you know, I ran out of things that I knew would look good on him. And he's right. Like, oh, do you have anything else? And I'm like, well, I do, but I don't think it's going to work. He's like, oh, it's okay. I'll try it on anyways. So it was very clear that we were enjoying each other's company. And we got talking about surfing. And he's like, oh, yeah, I used to surf in Australia. And this was February, so there was like a big swell coming on the weekend. And I'm like, oh, no way, like there's a big swell coming this weekend. If you want to get out and surf, I've got a few extra boards. I have some wetsuits. Like, you know, you can come out with me and my buddies. And he's like, oh, yeah, that'll be awesome. You know, I'm totally down. Let's do it. So he left the shop with two pairs of jeans that he couldn't afford and my phone number. And we had made plans to go surfing. And, you know, little did I know that he actually had tried surfing once in Bondi Beach and had stood up on a 10-foot board with an instructor pushing him on a wave. And here he had signed up to, you know, go out on a big swell with me and my buddies. Yeah. So he texted me a couple hours later and we started, you know, texting back and forth. And through text messages, we figured out exactly, you know, what we're both after. And we ended up going and watching the sunset together. And and that's kind of like how our relationship started. We didn't start dating until like 5 months after that, till he came back to San Diego. But, you know, when he came back, we totally fell in love and we decided to start a life together. So I finished school, I moved up to Vancouver with him, and then we traveled for his the additional training he had to do a couple of fellowships in Melbourne, Australia, Dallas, Texas. So I went with him, and then he ended up taking a job in Toronto, and that's how he ended up in Toronto.
Oh, right. Yeah. And then that's where you've been ever since, obviously.
That is correct. So it's coming up to 12 years now since we moved to Toronto.
Wow. And, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the surfing, I mean, that's kind of from what I gathered from my interview with him, that's kind of where his photography started, I think. I think he was saying that you were out surfing and he was out sort of starting to take pictures of you and the other surfers in the bay there.
Yeah, that's correct. So I believe it was a trip that we took to Barbados. It was our first time in Barbados, where I took him out surfing and he had a case for his iPhone and he surfed with me for a little bit. And he's like, oh, you know, I'm not doing great. I'm just going to bring my board to the car and I'm going to go get my camera and I'll come out, just take a couple photos. I was like, okay. So he went and got his phone and his case and came back and started taking some photos of me surfing and a couple of the other surfers. And he was so happy in the water. He was so like in his element and so comfortable. He was such a strong swimmer. And when we got back to the car, he was showing me the photos and I just could see so much joy in his eyes. And it's just like, oh my God, this is so cool. Look at these photos that I got and had such a great time out there. I had more fun taking photos and surfing. And I was like, well, you know, that's amazing. So I think we found something for you to do while I surf. So he started, you know, that's when we started surfing here on the Great Lakes as well. So he started getting out here and getting the water and taking photos. And I had a DSLR camera for my design studio here. So I looked into a water housing case for him and we got him a case and he just started getting out to shoot our sessions whenever we got out to surf. And that's like, he became well known in the community. He was like the first surf photographer to get in the water here in our area. So people always got excited when Lucas was in the water because he would bring so much positivity and he was always, you know, like someone would go by, he'll take a photo. He was like, oh my God, next time come closer to me or try this or try that. Right. You know, and he's such a positive person that, you know, people really embraced him as a surf photographer here. And that's kind of how things started, you know, for his photography. So he did that for a few years and, you know, he went off and shot some surf competitions like in Tofino in Canada. He shot a couple WSL events, you know, internationally. We travel all over the world to surf and, you know, I would get out to surf some heavier waves. He would never be afraid of, you know, swimming out a pipeline in Hawaii or, you know, Zicatela in Puerto Escondido or, you know, some bigger, heavier stuff. He was always there, but you know, something was missing for him. Like he wasn't getting, you know, the acceptance from the surf community in all these different places, from the surf industry in general, you know, to be a part of that. And it wasn't until I had to undergo a spinal surgery that kept me out of the water for about 6 months that he actually started doing his editorial work. So basically it started, like, I had my surgery. I told him, I was like, honestly, get out of our friends to shoot, you know, like, they'll let you know when they're going, you get out there. And he went a couple of times and he was like, oh, it was fun, but it's not the same without you in the water. So I don't know, I'm just gonna, you know, wait until you get better to get back in the water. And he had just bought a new water housing. He had changed, you know, the company that he used for his water housing. And he's like, oh, I'm just going to find a pool and I'm going to find someone to, you know, just so that I can start practicing with my new housing. So he had a clinic as a surgeon at the varsity. He had a clinic as a surgeon at the University of Toronto, where they took care of most of the varsity athletes, you know, for the University of Toronto and professional hockey players and baseball players and whatnot. So there were two teams there that he connected with. One was the University of Toronto swimming team. And at the University of Toronto, they had this gay water polo team that met on a regular basis. So he reached out to both of them through his connections from the university, and they invited him to come shoot their practices. So that's kind of like how he went from surfing into the pool. So initially he was just like shooting, you know, water polo and kind of like the action of the sport, and he was getting some pretty interesting stuff. Then I think it was about like 2 months into my recovery, he had invited three of the swimmers from the university's varsity team to come and do a shoot with him at this beautiful pool that was part of the university. But it's like a very historic pool with beautiful lighting. And he managed to reserve the whole pool for like 2 hours. So I was like starting to recover. It was my first time back into a body of water. So he was like, hey, I want to do this shoot. Like, do you want to come with me and help me out? I was like, sure. So we went there. We removed all the lane ropes. We had like this 50-meter pool all to ourselves. And the guys were super awesome. They already knew him like from the practices. And he started doing a few things. And then I remember he called one of them. He's like, hey, Mitch, can I just get like a hero, like, you know, captain of the swim team photo, like, you know, a pose that you would pose, you know, on land, but I want to try to sink you to the bottom of the pool. So, you know, I'm going to set my frame and we're going to let our air out and we're going to sink to the bottom of the pool. And I just want you to like cross your arms, look right into the camera and just stay calm. And they went down and, yeah, I went down with him and, you know, I saw him click, 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 click. And then he came back up and there was just like this big smile in his face. And like he showed me the photo. I was like, oh my God, that's stunning. Like I've never seen that before. And it was that shoot that after that, he started trying a few things with the other models or the other swimmers. And I remember it was that photo that blew up his Instagram. Like when he put that on his Instagram, you know, things just blew up and a whole new world, you know, opened up to him. And that's basically how his photography practice, you know, changed courses. And, you know, he just like, he barely even shot surfing after that. He only got out when the conditions were perfect or when we were traveling and like it was super challenging that the waves were really big or we're like on a boat on another reef. Like, you know, the day-to-day stuff is like, yeah, not worth it anymore. You know, I'm really passionate about this underwater tutorial work.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of his iconic look now is that those pictures of male subjects under the water with a kind of like a, you know, there's like a muscular sort of sporty sort of side to it, but it's more artistic than editorial, than, you know, documentary.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's interesting about his work is that it's super physical, you know, to get those images, like it requires so much from him, from the subject, the connection between the two of them, so much coaching in terms of, you know, mindfulness and just the breath holds and, you know, and I watched, you know, a lot of the shoots, I just watched like that relationship develop. Like I did a lot of, you know, I teach yoga and I teach mindfulness as well. So I did a lot of mindfulness work with him and with his subjects, like on the pool deck or, you know, outside of a body of water so that, you know, they could get into the, you know, the mindset, and he did a lot of the coaching for the breath work. And I could see that progression. So there was a lot of physicality to go down and to find that, you know, comfort. But somehow in that process, he really managed to tap into the subject's vulnerability, because it was a foreign environment for them. It was something that he was helping them to feel comfortable with. And there was a certain moment in the shoots where they reached that. And that was when things every time got really interesting. And I think what's really interesting is that he managed to capture those beautiful men, you know, as strong men, but also he managed to capture like the most fragile side of them, you know, at the same time. And it's something that it's central, it's desirable. And it's not just desirable by gay men. I think it's desirable by anyone who looks at that photo. It's not a, you know, it's not sexual, it's sensual. To me, I think it's art. I think what he produced, it's just beautiful, creative, innovative art.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think like from what I found of his work was there is that, you know, there's these amazing physiques. It's a beautiful showcase of the male body. But as you say, it's also this softness, this vulnerability in there where it's not a sexual thing at all. It's just a person being themselves underwater. And I think, you know, it takes a certain person to be able to get those sorts of shots from people, you know, someone who has some empathy and some, you know, some sort of emotional insight. And I think that was Lucas.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So what's happening now? So in terms of his work and his gallery, I know you've sort of taken on his legacy and kind of continuing with it. What's the plan there? What do you sort of doing with all his previous work?
Yeah, he has so much work that I just started going through, you know, everything that he has printed. And I just started organizing his hard drives. But yeah, he's got about five hard drives that are filled. He's got about five hard drives that are full with all these shoots that he's done over the last decade, I would say. That, like, I honestly, like, I was there for most of the shoots, but I have only seen a small percentage of the photos he got, because his process usually was he would shoot and then he would select, you know, like his top 20, and those were the only ones that he would show me. And, you know, I'll give him some feedback and we'll chat about the things that were working, that were not working. Yeah. So I'm yet to see, you know, everything that he got. And so I'm a graphic designer. Like, I used to design publications, and, you know, I come from a design background, and, you know, I used to work as an art director. So I have a slightly different editorial eye than he had. So I'm actually really excited to start going through his archives, because I know there will be some absolute gems there that he might have not seen it, you know, at that time, or maybe, you know, his practice wasn't developed to the point that if he had had the chance to go back, he would say, oh yeah, that's an art piece right there. So, but that's going to be a process. It's going to take time. I'm in no rush. Like, this is something that I want to do for the rest of my life, you know, manage his studio, and I'll see what, you know, what time brings. I've been working with one of his agents who's a curator in France. He's giving me some advice on, you know, how to do this properly. And I'm just really excited to have that as part of my life. You know, speaking to you at a podcast about his life is something that is bringing me so much joy. I have given a couple interviews to a couple magazines already about his work. And I don't know. We'll see what happens. But I plan on continuing, you know, managing his studio. Hopefully we can, you know, have new exhibitions of his work, you know, either if they're part of group shows or solo shows in different parts of the world. I would love to give continuity and to really, you know, make sure that his art legacy lives on. I'm sure there will be plenty of content for a second book at some point when the time comes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I, you know, the sky's the limit, and I'm just excited that, you know, I'll always have that as part of my life and my career.
I think that that kind of approach is so beautiful. You know, it is something on one hand, it's something that us photographers rarely get, which is a chance for someone to sort of dive into our archives and look through the work that we've done and sort of find the things that we just glossed over. You know, it's like a second chance. There was someone said this recently where some of the most amazing artwork in the world is sitting in photographers' reject folders. So having someone like you go back through Lucas's work and sort of reselect all this sort of stuff, I think is a beautiful way to keep him alive. It's beautiful.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I agree. And he's done a pretty good job at like backing everything up. And so I'm just focusing right now on like, you know, organizing everything and saving everything, you know, several different ways in the cloud and the hard drive so that I know that I'll always have it. But, you know, there is no rush for that. That's going to evolve, you know, as the time passes.
Absolutely. Antonio, thank you so much. This has been an amazing insight into Lucas from the outside. So it's really great to be able to showcase, you know, kind of his life and to be able to sort of preface what we've already got of him and sort of get excited about what's to come from Lucas through you, through Antonio.
Oh, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I'm so grateful for you for, you know, talking to me and for continuing to honor his work, you know, after his passing. And yeah, there is more to come and I'm sure you and I will connect again at some point and I look forward to meeting you next time I'm in LA.
That would be amazing. Thanks, Antonio.
Thank you, brother.
If you haven't listened to my interview with Lucas from last year, please stick around. His insights into underwater photography make for a great listen. Lucas, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brett. It's a pleasure to be here or there or wherever we are.
Virtually, yeah. How is it up in Toronto? Are you actually on the water in Toronto there?
I mean, Toronto is on the water. I'm not directly on the water, but yeah, it's still cool here. I mean, April is not yet summer or spring, I should say. Some buds are starting to come out, but no, it's still chilly. We even had some flakes overnight and some blowing snow today.
Oh, nice. So it's kind of still crisp and kind of lively up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Considering our current world situation, it's not the worst time of year to have to spend extra time inside.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I'm in California, in LA, and it's been quarantine weather for me. So it's been pretty much gray and raining.
Okay.
Which is perfect.
That's nice that it's cooperating.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How is the quarantine and the kind of COVID situation up there? Are you guys stuck indoors? Is Toronto kind of on lockdown or what's the situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's always hard to compare and contrast other people's, you know, kind of what it feels like for them versus what it feels like here. I mean, I'd say, you know, Canada has been under some kind of modification now for about 4 weeks. And though it's been, each province has been doing it a little bit differently, there has been some kind of a cohesive plan from the federal level. You know, schools are closed, non-essential businesses are closed, people are being certainly strongly encouraged to spend as much time inside as possible. People are allowed to go out if they wanted to go for a walk, if they wanted to obviously go get groceries, that kind of thing. But yeah, nobody whose work is considered non-essential, all those people are really being asked to stay put.
Yeah. So is it quite quiet in the city there at the moment?
Yeah, it's kind of nice in some ways. I feel like now that we're kind of entering our fourth week, people are kind of taking their foot off the gas a little bit. Like, we were driving today to drop off a couple online orders from our shop, and it just seemed to be a few more people out and about. I think it's just, you know, people can't stay put for too long, so...
Yeah. I mean, once you get to that ending screen of Netflix where you've watched the entire thing, I think you have to leave the house.
Yes. When I was a kid, I used to get excited when I finished video games. But yeah, when I realized that we'd finished Netflix, that wasn't as satisfying.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know if there was a big boss at the end of that or not.
Yeah.
So how has the quarantine restricted you working at all? Has it kind of closed up a market?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the underwater photography for each of us plays a different role in our lives. It is a component of what I do. It is certainly something that I do professionally and something that I enjoy, you know, some modicum of success with, but it isn't my lifeblood. It isn't the thing that if you know, I had to stop, that I have to figure out, you know, how I'm going to pay the mortgage or pay the rent. We have lots of other things on the go. We have a little small business here. So that's where we've been focusing our energy. So no, but at the same time, I can't see any practical way that I would be shooting right now. Most of my work right now would be either in indoor pools, which are all closed, or I'd be traveling to shoot, which is also not a viable option. So yeah, I think I haven't been shooting, and I don't think I could be shooting over the last month.
Right. Is there other things in, I know you've got your store and you've got some other kind of revenue streams. Is there photography work that you could be doing, like post-production or pre-planning any shoots that might be coming up?
Yeah, I'm trying to use it. I've had a bit of a bumpy year health-wise, and this, it's funny, I was just kind of coming out of that as this happened to the rest of the world. So it was like, I felt like I was just gaining a little bit of steam, and then the bottom dropped out. But I mean, there's no good time for a pandemic. So I can't imagine that it's hard to feel too personally, you know, slighted by it. So yeah, I'd say I was on a bit of a ramp back up stage, and starting to find a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of creative juices starting to flow. And so I've tried to use this as a planning moment. I've spent a lot of time going back and looking at earlier work, and interestingly seeing my own stuff through a different set of eyes, because I think, you know, my world has shifted, as has everyone. So it's been a really fun time to go back through some hard drives and look at some things, and either images that I didn't like before I now like, or images that I saw in a certain way before I now interpret completely differently. And that's been, I guess, kind of an interesting retrospective to do, and has fueled some ideas moving forward.
Oh, that's great. I think it's always good to go back through your work, even if you get to see how you've evolved over a certain amount of time. And I think this whole COVID thing is doing that to a lot of us photographers, or even just creatives in general. I think this is someone's hit the pause button for us, and we have to kind of make the most of this time. And if we don't come out of this kind of changed in some way, I think it's almost not been worth the time sitting around, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of saying it. I mean, it's hard to say that it would be a wasted opportunity, but there is really, it is an opportunity to go back and do some things that you've been meaning to do. And, you know, I've always known that, you know, going back and looking through, you know, previous work was an important part of anyone's process, and certainly been advised that it's something that I should do, but I could never do it without just kind of getting down on myself and looking at it and being like, ah, geez, you didn't know what you were doing here, or look what you did with that. And boy, wouldn't it be nice if you'd known then what you know now. But I think I'm being a little kinder to myself, a little gentler. And maybe that's just it's a time for empathy outwards. And maybe that empathy is kind of, I'm churning it on myself a little bit too, and being a little kinder with what I'm looking at and how I'm feeling about it.
Oh, that's really interesting. Like kind of giving yourself a bit of a pass.
I think we have to right now. I mean, I think if you're hard on yourself now, it's hard to make it through the day. So I think as an artist, it's an interesting time to use that, some of those positive energies towards, you know, your own work or your own trajectory.
Yeah. It's interesting, like just seeing on social media and kind of Facebook and stuff, that not even just photographers, but people in general who are kind of taking this time to, you know, either learn a new skill, or they're doing the yoga every day, or they're like baking. It seems like everyone's kind of been forced into kind of looking after their lives a little bit more than just the usual grind of getting up and doing that same thing.
Yeah, I think it definitely, I think, I've seen some, you know, quarantine bingo cards where you can, you know, tick off all of the stations that may seem to be moving through, including, you know, cleaning out junk drawers and baking bread and doing yoga and all just kind of things that you say that you'd like to have more time for. And yeah, and I think trying to figure out what to do with that, you know, professionally, and I've watched some other photographers, you know, really crank up their ask for, you know, hey, I've got these prints, so I'd really like you to buy them. This would be a really good time to support artists. But I think it's really hard because you know, everyone is on a different arc with this. And I avoid using the word curve because that kind of implies, you know, something yeah. statistical or epidemiology or public health. But, you know, each of us are on our own arc in terms of our handling of this, our stages of grief, our however you want to call it. And you don't know where someone else is on their arc. And it's funny how there's certain asks that I received or certain emails or even ads that have popped up that just seemed so tone deaf or so, you know, bordering on inappropriate. And then another week later, I'm like, oh, I see what they're doing. That's totally cool. And they were doing the same thing. I wasn't ready to receive it in the way that they thought they were putting it out, that, you know, the week prior. And so I think as artists, it's hard to kind of say, oh yeah, support me, when everybody needs support right now. There's not a single person who isn't affected by this in some way. Not everyone is financially affected, because lots of people are still working. Some businesses in some strange way are benefiting from this, if they are in the, you know, telecommunications or software that, you know, that actually is helping a lot of these kinds of things, maybe, you know, similar to like what we're doing right now. But yeah, I think everyone is, you know, everyone's taking a hit here.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Well, let's take it back a bit. Let's go back to what you were saying about looking back through your old work. Mm-hmm. And can you give us a kind of an idea how you started in underwater? What was your trajectory there? What was your arc?
Yeah, sure. So I started, my photography really started when I got into surf photography. I had a camera when I was a kid and you know, did all the usual things, but never fancied myself as really knowing much about anything. And somewhere around Instagram kind of started around the same time as I started to get interested in taking pictures from the water. So in water surf photography, as opposed to that long lens on the beach, but actually bobbing around out there with the housing. And that's, you know, I actually learned how to take proper photographs from the water, and any dry land photography that I've done since then, it's kind of with the lessons that I've learned from the water. And I think it's kind of a backwards way to go about it, but it's an interesting medium to start in. And I really enjoyed surf photography. My partner is a keen surfer, and it was a way for us to kind of meet on a common ground, because I could never keep up with him as a surfer. I just wasn't any good. And so it turned out that if I really enjoyed taking photographs of either him surfing or other surfing or big days, then we would have a shared shared interest and a shared level of desire, you know, when it was crowded or when it was big. Those would be days that I would shy away and I would want to have, you know, just really, you know, beginner waves with nobody else out there. And that was kind of boring for him. And so it allowed us to kind of align a little bit better. And I got, you know, I was lucky to start taking some photos here on the Great Lakes, which is a whole kind of subculture of surfing, which is, you know, surfing with the wind swell here on Lake Ontario and Lake Huron.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask you about that because I was looking, my geography is terrible. So I looked up where Toronto is, knowing that you own like kind of a surf themed store. And I'm like, hang on, you're on a lake. Where does the surfing happen?
Yeah, it's a funny thing, you know, lake surfing. So it's, you know, most swell that happens, you know, is related to storms that are far, far away. And it leads to this ground swell that, you know, travels thousands of miles. And that's where you get those pristine waves that, you know, hit the North Shore of Hawaii in the wintertime. If you get a windy enough day on a big enough lake, it can, you know, much like a snowball rolling down a hill, as it crosses the lake, it can build up momentum to the point that we get quite impressive surfable waves in the right spot at the right time. It's a whole, you know, if surfers are already misfits, you know, this is definitely, you know, misfits of a misfit sport. Right. And we get to kind of, in that we started a surf company and shop here that we're somewhat of a, you know, a meeting place or a community hub for what is a pretty amazing community.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds incredible that you're on a lake and you own a surf shop.
Yeah, it's either...
And there is this culture around it as well.
Yeah, it's either a very bad idea or a very good idea. It's probably nowhere in between. And the jury's probably still out. But it's it was through that that I was able to maybe progress with my photography a little bit faster, because there was a pretty ready audience that was interested. There weren't other photographers in the water because... You know, there weren't that many surfers in the water. So I wasn't there, you know, at Pipe trying to line up behind six or seven established professional photographers trying to get a shot. People were happy because I was the only guy that had a housing that could jump and was willing to jump in the lake, you know, when it was as cold as it is when we surf here. Dang. Oh, I mean, we surf here right through the winter. So it'll be below freezing and we'll be in the water. But the nice thing is, as long as it's, you know, as long as the water is liquid, you know, it's at least above freezing. So, but yeah, we'll be in the water when it's, you know, in Celsius would be, you know, 2 or 3 degrees. So
right.
In Fahrenheit, yeah. I guess that would be in the 30s. So it's pretty, it's a pretty wild concept. So if you've ever seen those kind of ice beards or, you know, icicles hanging down off people's faces, that's usually a lake surfer 9 times out of 10. But, and I kind of, so I cut my teeth a little bit on lake surf photography. And then when I got to the ocean, I was like, well, this is much nicer. This is much warmer. The waves are much bigger. The lighting's much better because we're surfing on days where the sun's actually out. We're surfing on days where this, you know, the day isn't actually just, you know, 8 hours long like it is in the winter here. So, you know, water clarity was up. The ability of surfers went up. They stopped wearing wetsuits, you know, so they were a bit more photogenic because they didn't look like all of these anonymous penguins that surfing cold, you know, photographing cold water surfers can do.
And head to toe in neoprene. And
yeah, it's really, and that's a, if you're trying to grab focus, somebody dressed in all black and moving on a overcast day through murky water, my hit rate was not very high when I was starting out. I am very comfortable saying. But yeah, I got to you know, start shooting in other parts of the world. So, you know, took the what I had learned to trips to New Zealand and Australia, to Brazil, to California, to Hawaii, to Barbados, you know, among a few other places. And that's where I started to kind of get to shoot some bigger waves, some better surfers, and you know, still not really, no one was particularly interested in my work really at that time, but I was at least being, you know, physically challenged by it and being able to, you know, be in places that I never imagined I would be.
And were they personal trips, or was that something to do with your work, or how did that work?
Yeah, I mean, those were really personal trips at that time. I mean, we were starting this surf brand and we had kind of ideas about how these would, you know, work together. And certainly the photography was serving that purpose, but it certainly wasn't making any money, and it wasn't funding any of the equipment that I was buying or anything like that. Right. It was just, you know, I just figured, you know, I was really conflicted about this at the beginning with surf photography, because you sometimes would get these either kind of funny looks, or you'd get somebody who just ask you kind of directly. They're like, well, like, why are you out here? Like, is anyone paying you to do this? And I used to get really insecure about that. I would just be like, yeah, why am I out here? I mean, is this weird that I'm out here? And then one day I was just like, well, you know, why wouldn't I just ask the surfer the same question? Like, why are you out here? Is anyone paying you to be out here? Did anyone pay for your flight to come here? Did anybody pay for your board? You seem to be enjoying yourself. I'm enjoying myself taking photos. So maybe it's okay to sink a little money into a hobby and go places. I mean, if people can go on ski trips or golf trips or, you know, other things like that, I mean, why couldn't I go on photography trips?
That's how
I had to reconcile it myself. But I mean, it was funny that there was a little moment where I was like, well, yeah, what? This is weird. Why am I out here? And then I was like, no, this is, I'm okay.
And so what sort of time frame are we talking? How long ago was this?
That would have been, you know, for a span of about kind of 3 years, about 3 years ago. So 6 years ago, for about kind of 3 years, I was doing that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. And so then where did it go from there? Because, I mean, you're known for underwater male athletic kind of art sort of shots.
Yeah,
how did you go from surf to that?
Yeah, I guess it's who was it? I think it might have been Miles Davis or another great musician said it took him a long time to figure out how to play like himself, or to, you know, to play the song his way or something like that. And I really, he worded it much better than that, but I heard it the other day and I kind of said, because what we try is we try to take photos like other people, you know, we try to take, you see something and you're like, oh, I should try to take a photo like that. Or
yeah,
I was trying to get my work, you know, accepted by a, you know, a magazine or maybe a brand would be interested. And I even had a chance to go shoot, you know, a couple of WSL, you know, pro competitions down in Barbados. And I just was like, I wasn't getting any love, you know, it was kind of like this unrequited desire for validation or acceptance. And yeah, I really found myself trying to take photos that I thought other people wanted to see. And in retrospect, you know, if I was giving advice to myself 3 years ago, I would say, well, you know, that's never going to work. Like, why would you be doing that? But at the time, I didn't know any better, and it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. I had just actually come back from Barbados, shooting the down at Soup Bowl, you know, in a pro competition. It was November, and it was, I can't remember why it was. Oh, actually, it was my partner was going to be having elective back surgery, like nothing too, you know, right. Still back surgery, but nothing too, you know, serious. But I knew we were going to be grounded for a little bit. Like we weren't going right. anywhere. We weren't going yeah. on any big trips. And I just wanted, and I was kind of coming to this realization that as a surf photographer in Toronto, I was unlikely to ever reach any level with this that I was going to be happy with. You know, I'm a pretty competitive guy. I'm pretty goal driven in other aspects of my life. And so mm-hmm. I'm sure there was a part of me that was like, you know, are you really going to settle for kind of just being sort of okay at this? And if you can't ever have access to the best conditions, the best light, the best riders, I just wasn't feeling like I was kind of, you know, creating what I wanted to be creating.
And right, because you weren't in the right environment to be your best.
Yeah, I guess so. And so I kind of just started to get creative and thought, like, well, how could I shoot more? You know, I just loved being in the water. I mean, it was such that's a common thread, I'm sure, for all of us, is that's my happy place. I mean, when I'm in the water, I go back to all the things I felt when I was a kid. I feel creative. I feel, it's just, it's on all levels. And really can't even be overstated how much that's the, you know, that's the driver for me, is just being out there shooting and now under there shooting is why I do it. And the product is almost a byproduct, because the actual satisfaction and joy comes from the process of the gathering, not in what is gathered. So
yeah, it's almost that resulting photo is kind of secondary to the experience.
Yeah. And I would say probably more so in the beginning, because maybe what I was actually, you know, creating wasn't living up to my mind's eye. But I also, I don't think I really had a mind's eye. I don't think I really, and that was, you know, looking back, I didn't have an image in mind that I was trying to capture. I was just capturing what was happening. I was a, you know, a documentarian. I was a bit of a bystander that just happened, you know, maybe I was capturing what was happening in front of me, but I wasn't going out there that day and saying, ah, okay, I see. So the sun's going to be rising here. And I know that this water will do this. And I know if I shoot, you know, at this f-stop, then that's going to, the sun's going to flare and this, but you know, these are the things that I know now, but I wasn't then. And
yeah, and you were just being reactive rather than trying to
reactive versus being proactive in terms of that. And so, you know, back to your original, you know, kind of questioning about how, you know, where it shifted, I would say, you know, that winter, I just wanted to shoot more. And so I reached out to, I think in one day, I reached out to two different groups. I reached out to the head coach of our university swim team here in Toronto, and a LGBT water polo club that I had actually, you know, played a few games with, or had, you know, done some practices a couple of years ago, because I used to play water polo back in high school, and just said to both of them, hey, here's some of my surf stuff. I'd love to come and, you know, take some photos of you guys, you know, in practice sometime. Would that be okay? And, you know, within 24 hours, both of them had gotten back to me with an enthusiastic yes. And so there, I think 3 days later, I was, you know, in one practice and then in the other. And that's
great.
that's where it shifted into the pool, and that's where it shifted. But even there, I was still doing over unders. I didn't have the shots in mind yet. It was just like, oh, and then I kind of slipped underwater and I started to go, oh, this is cool. Oh, look what a fisheye does underwater. Oh, look what look what a rectilinear wide angle lens does underwater. Look.
Yeah.
Look
so at that point, you hadn't even really gone fully under. You were still kind of at the surface.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know what I was, because really I hadn't done any underwater stuff with any of my surf because I'd never been in a, Indonesia or Fiji or somebody or even Hawaii, in good clear water. Yeah. So every shot I took underwater just looked, cloudy it may have given a cool distortion to the bottom half of the frame, but it was never what we would consider to be a good underwater photo by our, current or at least I should say for myself, by my current standards. So yeah, so it was the pool that, and it was those two sports teams that helped me move from kind of above water to underwater.
And did you find that you were still, when you were dealing with those teams, were you still kind of documentarian, or were you starting to kind of control the action as well? Like, were you starting to direct?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Brett. It was certainly for the first, three or four, that's probably what I did, was kind of maybe three practices with each of them. And it was very much capturing what was going on, partly because I was trying to be a fly on the wall and not interfere with their practice. And, this was a, competitive swim team that had a couple Olympians on their roster. And I didn't, it wasn't for me to say, even though I had a head coach that was like, what do you need them to do? Should we do some stuff off the blocks? Do you want them all to go in at the same time? And I was just like, I don't know. Just clumsily trying to just not screw up and figure out how to stay down, how to, because I hadn't worn a weight belt before when I was doing the stuff above, because the idea of when you're doing surf photography is to not go underwater. You try to stay on the surface. This was a whole different kind of, I was like, oh, I'm going to have to weight myself to get down there. And so, yeah, it was doing that. And something in my head was like, yeah, this is cool, but I'm still just taking pictures of swimmers swimming. I'm taking pictures of water polo players playing water polo. I'm not creating anything. I'm just, once again, I'm capturing, and I'm getting some cool angles. Like I'm seeing this, I'm showing people this world from a perspective they perhaps haven't seen it before, but there's nothing emotional about it. When I look back at those images, I don't go, maybe some that more the architecture of the pool was captured and the swimmers were really moved to minor characters in the frame. I think those shots, when it was swimmers, I look back at those and I really like them. But any kind of in close shot of someone swimming from an underwater perspective is a bit of an awkward angle, at least to my aesthetic and to my eye. And it was only when I say got up the nerve, because that's what it took back then to say to, one of the swimmers that I thought might say yes, I said, hey, if I could find a pool where like it's just you and I in the pool and we can start to kind of try some stuff that isn't just in practice, would you want to try that? And I was looking back, it's so funny about how afraid I was to ask that question. And I kind of understand now why I was so afraid, but it's funny to think how easy it is to ask that question now and how hard it was then.
And is that just because of a confidence in your own work?
Yeah, I think it was probably more than that. I think it was, not knowing what it was that I wanted to create. And even looking back at that first day shooting with him, all we did was take pictures of him swimming in an empty pool, but at least we didn't have those distracting elements like lane ropes or somebody else with a flutterboard or mismatching, bathing suits or other people in the frame or those kinds of things. Yeah. So, I mean, it was becoming more pure in that sense. But to be honest, it was because I was having to reconcile the fact that I thought that he looked really good underwater. Like I thought he looked really beautiful. And that was my own personal, as a gay man, I was like, oh, I'm a bit, not conflicted, but I'm like, okay, but is it okay for me to want to photograph him because I know that what he looks like and he looks good? And can I combine that with my, you know, professional life outside of that, which for me is being a doctor and working at a hospital. And mm-hmm. the other part of that is, you know, taking photos and kind of saying, you know, what is the role of somebody like that in that situation? So that was a real kind of moment of reckoning or reconciliation or something that I had to process in order to figure out the kind of photography that I now, you know, feel so comfortable doing.
And so, I mean, that's a very interesting point where you're a gay man and you're taking pictures of, you know, good looking men under the water, and how that changes into your private life or into your, you know, your working life. Do you think there's a disconnect or a correlation with society in terms of men taking pictures of beautiful women and men taking pictures of beautiful men? Is there some kind of disconnect there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting area and one that I'm not sure that I fully have my head wrapped around. But, I have friends that have, you know, one of my close friends actually said something about, we were talking about my work, and he's been super supportive. He's one of the first people that I shot and got to kind of, you know, try saying, well, what if you do this? What if you do that? And he was a gamer. He was like, yeah, sure, we'll try that. So I would say he was one of my early, you know, models or subjects. But even a year later or 2 years later, you know, when it was coming to, you know, putting out my work and, you know, putting up a show and putting out a book, he said something about my work being gay, you know, like that the photography was gay. And then I kind of said, well, is the photography gay? Like, are the images gay? Like,
is it gay just because I'm gay?
Yeah. And so if a woman was taking a picture of a woman, would that art be considered, you know, lesbian? But if people said, oh, but no, but she's married, so she's straight, so the work's not lesbian. You're like, well, hang on a second. What is it that we're, you know, what are we talking about? Like, is it, we're talking about we're placing men in a unconventional position, both in the sense that they're in an underwater environment, which obviously is foreign to a lot of the poses and direction that I'm giving them. But I'm also trying to tap into a softer side, a level of vulnerability, maybe some roles that aren't typically considered, you know, masculine or heteronormative. But, you know, if my model's straight and the photographer's gay and it's just one guy in a photo, is it a gay photograph? Is it, you know,
yeah.
But that was, I mean, that's a whole other, you know, that's probably a whole other podcast, but I find that very, very interesting where someone's work is placed based on what you know, or you think you know about the artist, even if the work itself doesn't necessarily go there, because I'm very cognizant of that line with my, as I'm sure many of us are who do a lot of work where the model might be nude, semi-nude, or some line in between. It's very easy to, even when you go through your shots, you kind of look at something and you're like, ooh, like that's crossed that line. We didn't try to cross that line, but there's just something about that pose that's a little more, maybe we'll use the word lurid, or it's more erotic than it is emotional. And yeah. we're going to kind of say we're not going to keep that one. We're going to go more for this one where there's something being a little bit held back. And that's where my line is, right? Like that's the one I dance around, and somebody else is going to say, oh no, my line's over here. Or no, I don't have a line. Or no, I can't even get, you know, anywhere close to that other image. And maybe that's where I was back then, is I, as a gay man, could I ask this attractive male model who was either gay or straight, I didn't know, if he was willing to do a photo shoot with me where I was choosing him to do that photo shoot because I knew that he was aesthetically pleasing. And maybe it's because I haven't come at this, you know, all my training was in, you know, sciences and medical school, and no one, I wasn't brought up in this idea of, you know, fashion photography or other realms where the aesthetics of the individual were, that was the reason everybody was there. I mean, of course, like that's why a model is a model. That's why this is on the cover. That's why we're doing this. That's why we're doing that. But I was having to reconcile that coming from maybe a different kind of headspace.
Oh, totally. And I think what you're saying is these are questions that photographers are asking themselves, I think, when in their early days, if they start doing these kind of, you know, more art, more nude kind of photography, and regardless of the subject's kind of sexual orientation or the photographer's sexual orientation, I think these questions need to be asked of yourself. Is this okay? Is this going to cross a line? And if that line is there, is it just my line or is it a line that everyone shouldn't cross? Like
yeah.
It's such a universal kind of thing. And regardless of whether you're shooting with men or with women, I think that's still a question that should be coming up.
Oh, no, absolutely. And you know, when I shot my first nude subject, it was a funny situation because we were, I think, having lunch and we realized we were staying at the same hotel in Palm Springs, which just happened to be a clothing optional hotel. And I said, oh, but it's got a great pool, you know, let's do a photo shoot. But I wasn't even thinking. I literally had shot like this swimmer, you know, at the university like 5 days before this. I hadn't figured out what the hell I was doing yet. And he just like drops his shorts and jumps in the pool. And I was like, oh, I guess this is what we're doing. Okay. I guess I'll just keep shooting. And he kind of he had done a lot of photo shoots. He was very comfortable and he kind of told me what his parameters were. And I was like, okay. But now I'm like, okay, what the hell do I do with these photos? Like am I going to post a, you know, just a butt cheek, right? But I'm like, can I post a butt cheek? Like, can I do that? And what, yeah, that was a whole, yeah, that was an interesting, looking back, it seems comical, but at the time it certainly didn't feel like it.
But I think that's a very interesting thing because looking at your work now, you're obviously not shy of shooting that sort of, that style of photography. How long did it sort of take you to kind of realize that posting a picture of a butt cheek was fine?
Yeah, I'm probably just posting the first picture of the butt cheek, you know, and then kind of going, because I'm not a prude about nudity, you know, myself. And I don't think growing up, I was taught to be overly prudish about it. It was a very much like a, we weren't going to, you know, nudist colonies or clothing optional beaches or that kind of thing. But the idea of just like quickly changing your shorts, you know, behind a tree was kind of, that's what we did. And maybe that's because you had, you know, there was four kids and it was just too much of a hassle to be overly precious about these things. But yeah. And I've never kind of felt too hung up about my own body or about other people's bodies. But it was more the moment I did that, I was putting myself out there as much as an artist as he was as a subject. I wasn't nude, but I was saying something about not necessarily my sexuality, but where I was willing to go with my work. And I was ready for whatever assumptions or interpretations that somebody wanted to make about that. And that, looking back, was a very big step.
Oh, yeah, definitely, I think. And so along those kind of lines, as a photographer myself, I work a lot with women. Mm. It's not particularly by choice. It's just because the style of work that I do, I think, is more interesting to women. It's more fantasy. It's more kind of, you know, fantastical sort of stuff. So when I do get to work with males, I don't really know how to direct them. It's a very different style of direction from shooting with a woman. I know what a woman looks good doing, whereas a man, and I am one, I should know how men look. I'm not very confident in knowing how to direct a male to pose. Do you think that that's something that came along for you, or is it something you always already knew?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I guess it's where I'm using my own personal aesthetic, my own personal assessment of what I think looks good. And sometimes that looks good as in that's well composed. His face doesn't look strained. I like his hand position. I like how all that kind of stuff. But then there's the other part of me that's just like, oh, that actually shows him off well. Now, not necessarily one of my least favorite subjects or my least favorite categories of subjects to shoot are professional models, because they have some preconceived notion of how they look best and how they want to pose and how what I'm going to need from them. My absolute favorite subjects to shoot are dancers, because they understand their body position better than anyone and can take cues. Even if we just come up to the surface and we say, hey, just a little bit here and a little bit, just a little more extended here and a little more flexed here, and you just go right back down and it's like, boom. They're not afraid to be nude a lot of the time, because they're very used to, dancing around quite scantily clad or changing, on the, in the wings or in the studio or something like that. And then I would say my equal to them are people who have done absolutely no photo shoots before. They have no preconceived notion of what looks good or what they should be doing. And one of the term muse, we sometimes use it a little bit jokingly, sometimes there are, but he's definitely been one of my go-tos. And I said to him once, I said, how is it like, I look every frame I take of you, I look through, and the only ones that I don't like are where I screwed something up. But you always look perfect. Like, how do you always, why is that? And he's just like, well, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, so I don't do anything. And I was just like, perfect.
So he's not overthinking or anything.
I need more people to do nothing or to do less, because less is more. And I think that's definitely, that's one of my principles. It's not true for everyone. I think sometimes more is more. If what you're going for is that grand image that looks, there's a complexity to its composition, to how the subject is dressed, how they're lit, how their body position. If it were to be stripped down, it wouldn't be the image that you or someone else had in mind. Every once in a while, I kind of stumble into something that looks like that, but usually my stuff is more, I would say, I try to go for that, remove, 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 less, 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 minimalist, and let there be two or three things that the eye can see, and then the rest is to the imagination as to why they're there.
I think that's totally true. And what drew me to your work in the first place, I think, was the minimal nature of it. It was very, I'm coming from a, let's put as much fabric in the water as we can, kind of.
But that's what I love about your work, right? I mean, that's what's, and we've talked about lighting before, through Instagram DMs, and, that's like your signature, right? Whereas I'm just not smart enough to use light that well, or technically savvy enough to know how to get it all to sync up the way I want it to. So I'm just looking for available light because it's all I know how to use. And so sometimes sometimes your limitations are your greatest strength. And if you can figure out how to harness those things, then go with it, right? And if you can't figure it out, then figure something else out. And then that will become your strength. But I was lucky enough that I had a limited enough toolbox in the beginning. And, that included access to pools, access to models. So I learned to be a scavenger. I learned to be to cajole individuals that, you want to try this. This seems reasonable. And was able to develop enough of a body of work and stumbled onto something at the level that I could show something to a prospective subject and say, hey, would you like to try a photo like this? And they would be like, yeah, that looks cool. But like the first guy that I said, would you like to try a photo like, I don't know what it is that I want to do.
Yeah.
Those are the guys that I have to go back and be like, I owe you an incredible debt of gratitude, because they took a chance on an idea that I don't even know what it was. They were just much like me, though. They were as happy to be part of the process because they really liked playing around with it, because they were water babies too. They just liked to be in the water. And so even if nothing good came out of it, they were like, well, that was a fun way to spend an afternoon, which is, obviously something that not all photo shoots turn into, but a lot of underwater photo shoots do.
And I think we find each other as well. I think in terms of like muses and models and sort of clients even who really push us to create bigger and better stuff. I think we end up kind of gravitating towards each other because of that love of water it kind of drags us towards each other.
Yeah, no, I think it's, and what you think is going to be the shot, what you have in mind, you know, sometimes you're right, but if you're open to seeing or hearing, or at least, you know, trying what it is that the other person is bringing, you know, to the shoot or to the, you know, I do a lot of pre-shoot work, and a lot of that is prep work, is in terms of building that relationship. So I'm often a big fan of doing a, you know, like a face-to-face meet, like a, you know, a coffee or at least a phone call. And then often we'll do some kind of dry land shoot to kind of just, so that I start to understand I understand their ability to take direction. They understand what it is that I'm after. I can get a sense of what their body looks like. What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? And then, and maybe only then, do we jump in the water. And of course, I've had other people where it's just like, well, we happen to be in Hawaii. There happens to be, you know, this crystal clear water. Why don't we both jump in and see what we get? And yeah, sometimes that's a great photo. And then other people, you do that and you're like, yep, not everybody should do underwater photography, which we've all experienced for sure.
Absolutely. And so talk to me about your business itself in terms of photography. Are you coming at it from a fine art point of view, where you're kind of taking photos that you're bankrolling and then selling them as prints, or have you got clients coming in who are paying you to shoot with you, and then they're getting the resulting prints?
Yeah, that's a great, that's a great distinction, or not distinction is the wrong word, but there's different models, right? There's different ways to do this in a financially viable way. And I have mad respect for people that do it differently than I do, because I probably, if I could, I would, and I just can't. And so I don't, and I do it another way. I think it was because I wasn't dependent on the outcome of the photographs financially. That wasn't what was going to pay the rent or, you know, pay for groceries that week. And so I could afford to just kind of sit on them, you know. And yeah, I say sit on them, I threw so much stuff up on Instagram, and in retrospect I wish I had held back a little bit more. But at the same time, that's when I was going through my, you know, my rise, and I probably wouldn't have gone through that if I wasn't being as active and putting in the algorithm was kind of working that way then for me. And so you can't kind of look back and say, oh, I wish I'd done this differently, because who knows what would have happened, right? So
why do you think you should have held back on some stuff? Was there things that you wanted to kind of keep in reserve for something else, or?
Oh yeah, I think it just would have made, you know, coming out with, you know, shows and books a little bit easier, because there was a lot of good stuff that once it kind of seen the light of day, even through social media, it loses a certain shine.
Yeah,
exactly. So I think, but at the same time, I needed to be shooting that much and producing that much and sharing that much in order to learn as much as I did, because it was just it really was a 2-year, it was bordering on manic in terms of how much I was shooting. And for somebody who didn't have a pool, you know, for somebody who didn't live by the ocean, how I was kind of gathering and doing as much as I was doing. And through that, of course, figuring out what it was that I wanted to say, or what my artistic voice was, or what my aesthetic was, it only comes through just producing, right? And producing doesn't necessarily mean publishing or selling. It means just shooting. Like,
it doesn't even necessarily have to be good.
It's sometimes better when it's not, you know, but it's nice when every once in a while one of them is okay, you know?
Yeah.
So I've been approached by a few different, you know, commercial opportunities. And of course, when they first came along, I jumped at them, because I was like, are you serious? You want to send me product and you want to pay me to, oh yeah, that'd be amazing. Oh, that'll be easy. No problem. Like fish in a barrel, like easy. And I would take on those things. First of all, I didn't really know how to take on, you know, a professional client well. I didn't know how to, you know, have a contract, or I didn't know what the correct language was. I had no idea what, you know, kind of how to budget it, or what numbers I should be pitching to them. So I'm not sure if I left money on the table or took more than I deserved or what, but I certainly didn't feel like I knew what the hell I was doing.
And what sort of clients were they? Were they brands or what?
So I've certainly had the, you know, would you take an underwater portrait of me? You know, for what's your, you know, what's your rate? Because I didn't have ready access to a location, I found the logistics of doing those ones challenging.
And yeah,
it's, and I think I also recognized that part of where my work was going was as much about how perfect the location was, maybe people, you know, body types and inclusivity and all that kind of stuff is a whole other conversation, but definitely people were liking a certain aesthetic of the guys that I was shooting. And that's where fantasy came from for me. Like you talk about fantasy through makeup or through hair or through fabrics or through light. Part of the fantastical part of my imagery, even in their simplicity, is in the either otherworldly or unachievable level of, you know, fitness or body type or whatever, to whatever ideal, whether it's, you know, Greek or Romanesque or contemporary, it doesn't really matter. There was some agreement that this was not a horrible looking individual, and that there was some benefit to there being an aesthetically pleasing subject, creating an aesthetically pleasing image. And I struggle with that a lot because, and I'm sure you face this and others, when people say, well, you know, it'd be nice if you took photos of more normal looking people or more average people, or is this the only type of person that you think is attractive? And I really, that it hurts, like, and it hurts probably because I, on some level, I struggle with that. But I think it's a little bit like if someone, you know, likes taking pictures of cars, like they're a car photographer. Do we begrudge them if they only take pictures of classic cars or supercars, or, you know, everything's shiny and perfect? Or should a car photographer be taking pictures of all cars?
Yeah, I think people don't realize how much the subject itself infers the photographer's skill. That's maybe a bad way of wording it, but I mean, I get those questions all the time. And it's, for me, it's like, why don't you take pictures of men more often? Mm. One of those reasons is because I don't get many men offering. Mm-hmm. But the other reason is I don't think I'm as good as shooting men as I am at women, because I know what I'm looking for with the female body. I know what's going to work. Whereas with men, I haven't kind of learnt that language. And I think it's the same thing with architecture. I could, you know, I know how to use a camera, but I don't think I'd look at architecture the same way as an architectural photographer would, to be able to get the kind of the soul in those shots. I think it's, you know, not everyone is a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, and I think we're, you know, when they say to a writer, you know, what should I write about? It's, I'll write about what you know. You know, if you're an artist, you should be creating from a place of what you know. It doesn't, you don't have to just put out there everything that you know, but what the art that you create is informed by who you are. And if you're not using everything that you are to create the whatever form of art you're creating, whether it's music, whether it's photography, whether it's painting, whether it's sculpture, then you're not really, you're selling yourself short and you're selling your audience short. And you're losing the opportunity to distinguish yourself from others, because the only way that you can be sure that your work is going to be distinguished from others is if you pour all of you into it, because nobody else can do that. Nobody else is you, and therefore nobody else's work can be like yours, because they don't have you to pour into their work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everything you do is flavored by yourself.
Like it's literally the lens that you see the world through. And for, you know, it's a bit of an obvious analogy for a photographer, but it's like, yeah, that's how I see things, and therefore this is what I portray. And a lot of my work is, you know, is autobiographical. And so for me to shoot more female subjects, I'm not necessarily, I don't know their story. I don't know where their emotions, their pains, their challenges. I know what my challenges have been, and I know what kind of unresolved or trigger points or emotions that I'm trying to convey. And the subject is the clay, or is the the medium is not the right word, but it's how I'm telling my story, because I can't take photos of myself. Some people do really cool self-portrait stuff that works in that way. But I mean, I didn't even know my work was autobiographical until one of my good friends, who's an incredible photographer, he said that to me once, and he was like, "Oh, I love how you can say so much about yourself through your work." And I was like, what do you mean? I'm taking pictures of other people. And he's like, yeah, but you're telling them what to do, and you're choosing the images that convey this, that, and the other thing. It's like, oh, is that what I'm doing? Oh, shit, that's what I'm doing. Oh, okay, I'm going to keep doing that.
So it's definitely working. So,
well, yeah. I mean, it's, yeah. So I think that's where the male subject thing comes for me too, is that I kind of understand it's not necessarily their story, but there is a synchronicity, there is a share, and maybe that comes through those pre-shoot consultations. It's like, where is the meeting point for us? What have been the chapters of your life? Here's a little bit about the chapters of my life. Where do those pages line up? And let's use those moments to create something together.
Yeah, totally. In along that vein, so thinking about people's experiences and them flavoring their work, are there people that influence you, or people that you really look towards and get excited about seeing their new work?
Yeah, I would say there are a number of artists that I respect and love, partly because I feel like I've learned about there's a couple that I've learned their, we'll call it their audacity, or their willingness to pour themselves into the work that they create. So I think, you know, Tom Bianchi and Robert Mapplethorpe would be two contemporary examples of that. These are two guys that just kind of were willing to, I don't say they didn't, you know, they didn't give a fuck, but they just said, like, this is my world and this is what I'm doing. And if I'm going to, they're incredible artists and they're going to put their work out there. And I guess I loved their bravado and their fearlessness to do that. And so I've always respected that. There's a couple, you know, the water photographers on the surf side that I've really always enjoyed their work. You know, water photographers like Ray Collins, Australian. He's what I love about him, not only is his story and how he's where art has kind of come into his life. And I often refer to coming into the art world through the side door. And, you know, and I think he did the same thing. And the reality, of course, is once you've been at it for a while, you realize that there actually is no front door and everyone comes in through the side door. But
right. Yeah.
But it feels a bit like an imposter syndrome at the beginning, but you then realize that you're using all that stuff to create what you're creating. But he's just one of those artists that I love looking at his work and saying, you know, when you know someone's really found something when you see an image and you know immediately that it's his without ever having to look, you know, for his name at the bottom of the page. Or if you see something that you think is his and it's not, you kind of go, you know,
but where does that influence come from?
Yeah. You know, but I mean, that's a whole other discussion, but his work, I'm tremendously inspired by, and I'm also inspired by his generosity and selflessness, you know, that I reached out to him and he just was one of those guys that just like, yeah, sure. What's your question? You know? And at one point it was about, you know, technical stuff about housing, and another time it was about, I think, sponsorship. And then another time it was about, you know, putting out my first book. And every time he was just like, here's what I tried, you know, here's what I did. And yeah. This is what worked for me. This is what didn't work for me. Take it or leave it, but it's here on the table for you. And that's not always the answer that you get from people. And so I just have incredible respect and love for people who are able to be so confident in their work that they can share so like unabashedly.
Yeah. And so humbly just kind of let it go. Yeah.
Yeah.
And share their experiences, which totally brings me to kind of the end of this interview, which is, it's been so awesome just to listen to your experiences and your kind of point of views on this whole crazy genre that we've kind of stuck ourselves into.
Yeah. I mean, I love any good conversation with somebody where there's some shared understanding and there's some overlap, but it's like a Venn diagram, right? Like we're you and I, and whoever else might be listening to this, we're our own circles, right? Where everything is inside, but there is some little point of overlap with you know, you and I have a point of overlap, which may be narrow or it may be big. We don't really know until we start exploring that. And maybe it's as interesting to find out what else is in your circle as there is to find out what is the zone of our overlap, right? And so, but it, sometimes it's that starting point. It's that common thread that, that can get you there. So yeah, when you asked me to do this, I was just like, sure, I don't know what it's about and I don't, it doesn't really matter because it sounds interesting. And I respect you as an artist and I respect the work that you're doing. And so I just, whatever I could do to be a part of something that you're working on sounded great.
Well, you've added to it already. So I think this whole podcast situation is just a whole heap of dots, circles, and they're all kind of starting to line up. And I think, you know, you've added to that really nicely.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. So thanks, Lucas. It's been awesome having you on here. And I'm going to let you go back to your lake surfing.
Thanks very much, Brett. I appreciate the opportunity. And I hope that your spring and summer come smoothly in California.
Yeah. Thanks, man. I'll speak to you soon.
Take care.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And as always, if you like the podcast, please subscribe, review, and share. If you'd like to support the production of these episodes, you can purchase our very cool merchandise at theunderwaterpodcast.com. We've got branded coffee mugs, stickers, beer cozies, and posters featuring our amazing illustration and logo by Joe Hodenow. If you'd like to connect with us or learn more about our guests, you can reach us at theunderwaterpodcast.com or on Instagram. We also have a Facebook group where you can discuss the episodes and even get your questions answered by the guests. There's a link to it in the show notes. You can learn more about my underwater photography workshops and mentoring at brettstanley.com or Brett S. Photo on Instagram. The Underwater Podcast is presented and produced by me, Brett Stanley, and our music is Neo by Oh Boy. Keep creating, everyone. I'll see you in the water.